You are listening to a sermon series from Open Door Fellowship Church.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much. So great to be back. So excited. I'm getting a little feedback. I know you can hear that. Okay, listen, first of all, thank you. Thank you for being here on this 4th of July weekend when my own family has chosen to not be here. My own kith and kin abandoned me. So thank you so much. I am just so grateful that your holiday plans have been didn't come through, and that you're able to come be with us. Right now, what's so cool is online, Amanda, who was singing, Amanda McFarland, her dad has brought a group from Alaska, 50 high school students, and they are in Tijuana watching this as they are working and building homes for more. So I'm so excited you are here, and we are so delighted to be with you guys, and I hope this is a great morning for you. Well, Yahoo. Can I just say personally how jacked I am for this series? I gotta tell you, if this is only for me, thank you for letting me just do this and enduring this series, because, wow. I'm going to ask some questions, and I wish I could just ask them to you and you could raise your hand, but that's a little embarrassing, a little bit too vulnerable. So I'm going to ask if you know anyone like that, and perhaps that person is you. Yeah. Would you just please not just go, I don't raise my hand because I do what I want to do. Don't just raise your hand if this is true. Do you know a believer who has lost joy in their faith? Thank you. Thank you for doing that. There's four of them, so just pace yourself. Do you know a believer who's moving away from their faith community in disillusionment? Yeah. Do you know a believer who is disappointed in why God does what he does? And finally, do you know a believer who is out there, wherever out there is, trying to find something that will satisfy them more than God? I think I may have been all of these at one time or another. Will you allow me to read this piece? Because I think it will help guide us in where we're going for these next weeks in this series. Once upon a time, there was a man who had everything most of us secretly wish we could have. He came from an incredible heritage of faith and success and power and fame. Now it has all become his. He has a sincere love of God. He's wealthy beyond description. To top it off, he's been given incredible wisdom and discernment. He's deeply needed. His country is at peace. And then, I don't know, time passes. And gradually, imperceptibly, something happens in the heart of this good man. He gets disillusioned. He gets frustrated and resentful at how unfair life is and how it all works or doesn't work. Instead of entrusting himself even more to God, this man pulls away and begins to depend upon his own reasoning more and more and more. He's trusting himself. Because of his incredible wisdom and knowledge, it takes a long time before anyone can tell it's happening, and by then it's too late. His dependence and confidence in God is eroding and being replaced by trust in his own wisdom and discernment. And one morning, he walks out onto the balcony of the palace overlooking a land belonging entirely to him. And he thinks these words, God, hey! So I don't think you understand me. I don't think you really know how to run this world right, if we're being honest. For I have all of this, and yet I am frustrated and resentful, and I am empty and bored and largely unfulfilled. I don't think you're willing to help me enjoy what I have. I don't even know if you know how to give me joy. I don't think you care enough about me. I don't think you're able to handle me. And I am coming to wonder if, after all, you really even are what I truly want out of life. I am tired of denying it to myself in the name of religious obedience. So, okay, I will still go through the forums and appearances. I'll wave to the crowds. I'll still honor you as maker of the world. But from this day forward, I will discover by my wisdom and my reasoning what will make me happy. You have not fulfilled me. You have not brought me enough happiness. You are way too much work. You're always trying to teach me something. And I'm tired of being taught, and I'm tired of needing, I'm tired of asking, I'm tired of being dependent. I own every created thing for as far as I can see, but I've not yet made it work for me. I'm the wisest man in the history of the world. And I will find out how to make it work to my advantage, to my contentment. I will now discover how to suck out every bit of joy and pleasure and contentment from each moment of life. I will not deny myself any pleasure or refuse my eyes any delight. You had your chance. This man earns $325 million a year in a non-inflated economy. He has 20,000 to 30,000 attendants, 1,400 chariots, 12,000 horsemen, slaves, musicians, all at his retainer to go on this journey. His name's Solomon. And this journal that he writes when he comes back is called Ecclesiastes. I rarely do this, but I want to do it because it's so well written. Eugene Peterson writes in the introduction before we start Ecclesiastes, if you'll bear with me, it's so, so good. Unlike the animals who seem quite content to simply be themselves, we humans are always looking for ways to be more or other than what we find ourselves to be. We explore the countryside for excitement, search our souls for meaning, shop the world for pleasure. We try this, then we try that. The usual fields of endeavor are money, sex, power, adventure, and knowledge. Everything we try is promising at first, but nothing seems to amount to very much. We intensify our efforts, but the harder we work at it, the less we get out of it. Some people give up early and settle for a humdrum life. Others never seem to learn, so they flail away through a lifetime, becoming less and less human by the year until by the time they die, there's hardly enough humanity left to compose a corpse. Ecclesiastes is a famous, maybe the world's most famous, witness to this experience of futility. The acerbic wit catches our attention, then the stark honesty compels notice. And people do notice. Oh my, how they notice. Non-religious and religious alike notice. Unbelievers and believers notice. More than a few of them are surprised to find this kind of thing in the Bible. Yeah, but it's most emphatically and necessarily in the Bible in order to call a halt to our various and futile attempts so that we can make something of our lives, so that we can give our full attention to God, who God is and what He does to make something of us. It is our propensity to go off on our own, trying to be human by our own devices and desires. It's why Ecclesiastes is such necessary reading. Ecclesiastes sweeps our souls clean of all lifestyle, spirituality, so that we can be ready for God's visitation revealed in Jesus Christ. Ecclesiastes is a John the Baptist kind of book. It functions not as a meal, but as a bath. It is not nourishment. It is cleansing. It is repentance. It is purging. We read Ecclesiastes to get scrubbed clean from illusion and sentiment, from ideas that are adulterous and feelings that cloy. It's an expose and rejection of every arrogant and ignorant expectation that we can live our lives by ourselves on our terms. Ecclesiastes challenges the naive optimism that sets a goal that appeals to us, then go after it with gusto, expecting the result to be a good and easy life. The author's cool skepticism, a refreshing negation to the lush and seductive suggestions swirling around us, promising everything but delivering nothing. It clears the air. And once the air is cleared, we're ready for reality, for God. American novelist Thomas Wolfe says these things about Ecclesiastes. Of all I have ever heard or learned, this book seems to me the noblest, the wisest, and most powerful expression of man's life upon this earth, and also the highest flower of poetry, eloquence, and truth. I'm not given to dogmatic judgments in the matter of literary creation, but if I had to make one, I could say that Ecclesiastes is the single piece of writing that I have known, the greatest one, and the wisdom expressed in it the most lasting and profound. Now, how do you look at this book? So many pick up Ecclesiastes and then go, hey, that's just weirding me out. It's a hard book. Guys, we can read this book and make absolute sense of it. This is for us. But for me, there's a great template for me to work through to start with. The very first thing that you'll see in here is verse 3, what advantage does man have in all of his work which he does under the sun? That you'll see that a lot in this, and you got to understand that's what he's doing. Solomon is saying, God, enough. I believe you're real. Yes, you're God, but I'm not going to deal with you. I'm instead going to look at what advantage is there for me. What can I do to make this work? Because you've been letting me down. So what under the sun is going to work for man that I can say, this does it? So if you understand that that is a template for Solomon's journey, and then there's going to be another thing, this self-referencing statement that tells me so much of where he is. It's the term, I said to myself. You'll see it all over this book, 9 times. 1:16 has it. I said to myself, behold, I have magnified and increased it down 2:1. I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure. He'll do that over and over. This self-referencing system, God, you're over here. Okay, I said to myself, self, what are we going to do? How are we going to do this now? How are we going to figure this out? How am I going to get the most out of this thing? God, stop it. Don't bother me. I will do this. And then I tested all of this with my wisdom. You'll see it over in 1:13 where he says, I set my mind to seek and explore by wisdom concerning everything that had been done under heaven. So I tested not with trust of God, not with anybody else, but all of this wisdom, I'm going to test it myself. So all three of those, if you could just understand, that's what Solomon's doing. And the conclusions are crazy sometimes and whacked out sometimes. And then there's one more thing. Every now and then, maybe 6-7 times in this book, he will talk about God. After all that he put him on the shelf, Solomon for a moment will say, oh yeah, oh yeah. Can I tell you the sad truth? Because I didn't want this to be true. Nothing can bring me joy or anything else except as a gift from God. Doggone it. I tried everything, you guys. And he'll come to that realization, just like he'll shake his head and get it for a moment. Then he'll go back again to some nonsense. But he, for a moment, will just get it. The best way for me to look at it is I love what we've done with this series, Life Worth Living, and we kind of see a tapestry. It says Ecclesiastes, And if you could just imagine, most of this book, Solomon is underneath the tapestry, looking at these jangled threads. He's just, it's all around him. Nothing makes sense. It all looks stupid. There's no order. There's just random colors, just like a really good tapestry would look if you just looked from under it. And that's where Solomon spends most of this book. He can't figure it out. But every now and then, God puts him on top of it, and he looks down and sees the full order of this life and this universe and everything. And for a moment, it makes sense to him, and he says, it's all God, you guys. It's all God. He's the only one who can make sense of it. So if you could get that visual picture of this, most of this book, he's in the weeds of all these tangled, gnarled threads, and about seven times, and when they come, they are so profound, he'll get on top of it. Does that template help? Thank you. That's for me. I have to see that, or it makes no sense to me at all. So we're about to enter the journey of one who tries to out every fantasy and secret ambition that we might secretly imagine. And God picks the perfect one because this cat has the capacity to try everything. And nothing's held back. And so every longing we feel denied by God that if we had it, it would make our life work, he stumbles back home years later, defeated, dejected, broken, jaded, empty, alone, and says, save your Uber fare. It ain't going to work. To give us some context, because the Bible, the actual written word of God, has it in a different order. 965 is when this kid, Solomon, a young Solomon, romantic, in love, playful, he writes Song of Solomon. This innocent, he does some pictures about the beautiful woman, and she's just like a psycho woman to me. She looks, the way she is described in there with the wheat and the does and fawns and stuff, it all freaks me out. It just, I don't want to know that person. But anyways, she's attractive to him in some weird way. And that's basically the Song of Solomon. You don't have to read it now. That's 965. It's a young, vibrant, on-his-game, romantic Solomon. And then 15 years later, in 950, he writes Proverbs. Maybe the wisest collection of writings of Proverbs of truths ever written. And in it, he's so tender, he's so humble. He just says, trust the Lord with all your heart. Don't lean on your own understanding. Every way, acknowledge him. He'll direct your paths. Proverbs. And then something happens. There's a 15-year gap now between Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. And that's what we're trying to piece together happens. In that 15-year period of time, Solomon goes on this journey. Here we go. Here's his starting words. Here's what drives him nuts. God, stay over there. Here's what I've seen. 15 years with all the words of the preacher, call himself this a lot, son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, emptiness, futility, meaninglessness, smoke, dead air, wasted time. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, it's all vanity. You tell me, what advantage does a man have in all of his work? Advantage is literally gain. It's that which is left over. After we've sucked dry all the immediate delight or the pleasure of something, what's left over, what endures that will remain to continue to feed the hunger of our lives for satisfaction, that highest gain, which if I find it, I won't have to look any further. What advantage does man have in all of his work which he does under the sun? Generation comes, generation goes. But the earth remains forever. It's backwards. Makes no sense. Man ought to be permanent. Nature ought to be transitory, but it's backwards. The sun rises, the sun sets, and hastening to its place, it rises there again. Blowing toward the south and turning toward the north, the wind continues swirling along. And on its circular courses, the wind returns and all the rivers flow into the sea. Yet the sea's not full. To the places where the rivers flow, they flow again. All things are so wearisome. Man's not able to tell it. The eye's not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear filled with hearing. That which has been is what which will be, and that which has been done is which will be done. Well, there's another new one to the sun. Is there anything of which one might say, hey, see this? Look, it's new. Already it's existed for ages, which were before us. There's no remembrance of earlier things, by the way. This is what drives me nuts. No, and also the latter things which occur, there will be for them no remembrance. Also those who will come later still. We feel so violated. Because when we learn life's great lessons, just as we're beginning to handle life properly, the next generation has to start all over from scratch again. I'm just now at 64 starting to become a little wise. And I'm losing my memory. Wisdom can't remember it. Hey, look, I've got something I want to say to you that's really wise. No, it's gone. Sorry. Anyone else? Yeah, okay, thank you. Faith is neither static nor earned from the past. Life continues every single day to test and reveal the heart. So, will you do this with me? Not just say you're going to do it, but actually go back to 1 Kings. It's right after Samuel and right before Chronicles. If you'd go to 1 Kings chapter 3, it's really important for us to look at this because it really gives us a great picture of Solomon. So, chapter 3, verse 3. Chapter 3 in 1 Kings, really powerful. This is when Solomon's rule is being consolidated and God's giving them the authority over the kingdom. And it's powerful to see what it says. Now, verse 3, Solomon loved the Lord. He loved the Lord. That means he loved the Lord. He knew the Lord's love. And he walked in the statutes of his father David. Then it says, too, that not just did he love the Lord, he had a humble heart. This guy who has now been given authority over God's people just says, oh, please, God, make me a good man. Please let me be able to shepherd these people well. He says down in verse 8, your servant is in the midst of your people, which you've chosen, a great people, which are too many to be numbered or counted. So give your servant, please, an understanding heart. To judge your people, to discern between good and evil. Oh, I want to love them. I want to protect them well. For who's able to judge this great people of yours? Then, so that's Solomon's request of God. And then God gives an answer back to Solomon. And this may be a key for us as a catalyst that God allows to speed the process up. Listen to what he says. God says, down in verse 12, well, behold, I have done according to your words. Behold, I have given you a wise and discerning heart so that there has been no one like you before and no one shall arise like you again. Wow. And I've also given you what you've not asked for. both riches and honor, so that there will not be any one among the kings like you all your days. Isn't that interesting? So this good man loves God, humble heart, given this incredible authority and wealth. He writes Song of Solomon. He wrote Song of Songs. He writes Proverbs. And then something happens, and nobody is exactly and completely sure. Maybe hurt, maybe disappointment or unmet expectations or boredom or strained relationship. Maybe through enough influence that he felt less need. Maybe arrogance or power. Maybe influence that tempted passion. Maybe he denied himself longings or lust or resentment at God's law. We can only guess by what he begins to look at. He starts to look and survey over this world that he feels in some way God has been holding out on him. God has been denying him stuff, and that has to change. It leads to a walk out onto a balcony, and then soon the changes follow. If you'll go back to Ecclesiastes, it's just one chapter over. In verse 10, you start to watch the change. Look in chapter 2, verse 10, where he says, okay, so, verse 9, I became great and increased more than all preceded me in Jerusalem. My wisdom stood by me. All that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart was pleased because of all my labor. And this, I want to tell you, was my reward for all of my labor. So he's starting to say, I deserve this. What I'm doing, I deserve. Either because of my hard work or self-denials or dishonor or hurt or pain. And soon it will bear fruit. Solomon is giving himself permission to disobey God if it means that he will get what he wants. And so we'll watch this. You don't have to turn there. I'm making you turn more than I ever do, usually. But in Deuteronomy, way back in the Pentateuch, when God says, I know you're going to go into the land now. And when you go into the land, it's just a matter of time. You're going to want a king. I don't want you to have a king, but you're going to do that. So, I'm just going to give you this warning. Please don't do these things. In Deuteronomy 17:14, he says, when you enter the land which the Lord gives you and possess it and live in it, and you say, I'm going to set a king over me like all the nations who are around me, well, you're surely going to set a king over you, whom the Lord you chose, your God chooses, one from among your countrymen. You shall set king over yourself. Don't put a foreigner over yourself who's not your countryman. Moreover, these three things. Make sure that he doesn't multiply horses for himself. If he doesn't do that, we're okay. Nor should he cause the people to go back to Egypt and get horses. Second, he shall not multiply wives for himself, or else his heart will turn away. So, no horses, one wife, so he can be an elder in a local church. Okay. Don't multiply horses. No, but one wife. And third, don't get a bunch of silver and gold for yourself. Within a short time after Proverbs, he does the trifecta of disobedience. He does all three in huge score. First Kings 11, 1 through 4 says, get your head around this. He takes local and foreign. He takes 700 wives and 300 concubines. The wisest man in the world? I say nay. I say nay. I can't do one wife well. 700 wives. Perhaps he's disobeying Deuteronomy a touch. How can this good, humble man disobey? How do we give ourselves permission? What happens? Well, this is our best shot by kind of coalescing a lot of Scripture. But maybe it starts with believing, God, you're not fair. You don't care, you're not able, you don't seem to satisfy, maybe you're angry. And then once that's true, well, then you give yourself a self-entitlement. I'm tired of being the bad kid. I get to do this. Then you convince yourself that you deserve it. Then you give yourself silent permission. And from there, a number of wrong roads can release my self-serving, self-protective, selfish choices. For Solomon, it was women, clearly. But you do very little. You would help those women, but you do very little for Solomon if you try to fix his issues with women, for his heart's still searching and longing to find the next thing because he's not yet satisfied in God. Solomon got tired under a religious pattern that did not answer his deepest longings. And this is a big deal for us because today, Nathan, if you'll bring up that next slide. We can forget that we have come to this faith not for a show of morality, not for a certain way of life, not for a better kind of squeaky, clean-looking kind of life, not for any appearance, not for proving, not for anything, but for an intensely and wonderfully intimate relationship with an actual living, breathing person, Jesus Christ. When I get that upside down like Solomon did, and I see God as this one who is keeping me from the good life, instead of saying, this is the good life, will you bring that back, Nathan? This intensely and wonderfully intimate relationship with an actual living, breathing person, Jesus Christ. Another thing this book does for me, I value wisdom so much, but if anybody proves that wisdom is not enough, it's Solomon. Whew. Let's go through the rest of that section there. Listen to what he says about wisdom. Verse 12, I, the preacher, I've been set king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I set my mind to seek and explore, but with wisdom, all that's been done under heaven. It's grievous, the task that God's given to the sons of men to be afflicted with. I've seen all the works which have been done under the sun. Behold, it's all vanity and striving after wind. What's crooked can't be straightened, and what's lacking can't be counted. So I said to myself, I magnified and increased wisdom more than all who were in Jerusalem before me, and my mind observed a wealth of wisdom and knowledge, and I set my mind to know wisdom and to know madness, to know folly, everything. And I realize that this too is striving after wind, because in much wisdom there's much grief. And increasing knowledge results in increasing pain. How could he be this wise and make such dumb choices? Over in verse 13 says, I set my mind to seek and explore. That combination of words is really important to see. This is what Solomon's going to do. Seek and explore by wisdom. Seek means to investigate the roots in depth, clinical facts, botany, to study the actual etymology of the word, to study how it lays out and ties into other things, to study all, investigate everything that I can. I'm going to scour all of knowledge and what knowledge can bring to my wisdom. And I'm going to learn it all. I'm going to be the most studied man in the world. And then explore means to examine all sides, to experiment. I'm going to pour all these different wines at different times of the day, at different amounts. I'm going to test everything. I'm going to take a sapling and a root and tie it together and see what kind of fruit that'll bring. I'm going to try everything I want to try and see if it satisfies me. I've added to this list since long ago because I wrote about wisdom at one time, and now I have a whole list of things about wisdom, if you pull that up. First of all, and this describes John Lynch for a lot of his life, passion without wisdom makes one loudly foolish. Wisdom without love makes one judgmental. Wisdom without humility makes one self-reliant. Wisdom without trust in God, as he says in 17 and 18, makes one, even more than anybody else, cynical and despairing. And wisdom without trusting God creates inaccurate conclusions. See, wisdom can only be wise in what it trusts. Wisdom without trust allows for an accurate description but a grossly inaccurate conclusion. He's throughout this book, you're going to read so many accurate observations and crazy conclusions. I mean, all things are wearisome, he says. Really? All things are wearisome? Really? Have you tried like a certain combination of ice creams together? Those don't weary me out. No matter how much I get it, they're not wearisome. 14, he says, everything's vanity, striving after wind. 2:17, he says, I hated life, for the work which has been done under the sun was grievous. Everything's futility and striving after wind. 4:2 and 3, this is a happy little thing that you could have in your daily devotionals. So I congratulated the dead who are already dead, more than the living who are still living. But better off than both of them is the one who has never existed, who has never seen the evil activity done under the sun. Kumbaya. What? Wisdom that gives an accurate description but an inaccurate conclusion. If you want to know what my best friends and family and people who know me best say about me, one of the things that they say about me, sometimes more loudly than at other times, they would say something like this. John, you often see with uncommon discernment and clarity, but your shame and insecurity issues then can cause you to make some really nutty conclusions. Yeah. Wisdom without trust brings a lot of grief because you see more clearly than most, but it brings fatalistic, jaded, despair, cynical, hopeless, dry defeat, like he says in 17 and 18. So Solomon now, first of all, he knows he's wiser than anybody. And so Solomon will become a closed system now, a self-referencing system. I said to myself, self, we're going to go this alone. Self, what are we going to do next? Self, Solomon, old buddy, wisest man around. Hey, stop it. I'm not talking to you. What are we going to do? He will become a self-referencing system. The problem with that is it works against wisdom. Humility is trusting God and others with you. Humility, it fosters trust. And trust then develops wisdom, which frees love, wisdom with love and hope and perspective and truth. I, although not having not even half of his income, I went on this journey for several years. And I almost didn't make it back home. And the thing is, you couldn't see it because I didn't want you to see it. But I got sick. I became a self-referencing system, and I said to myself, because I didn't trust anymore because I got hurt. And God didn't take care of that hurt on the timetable that I thought he should. For 3 years, maybe longer, maybe somewhere in there, I kept saying to myself, I got to do this. I got to figure this out. I got to make this happen. You guys, I know who I am in Jesus Christ. But I have a healthy fear that I could go back there. So I've now chosen, sometimes more than others, to let others in. Because as Michael Leah says, my head is a bad neighborhood. See, community breaks the cycle of life through safe, non-condemning, protective love. I'm reading, Ed Underwood loaned it to me, the letters to Mark about Jesus from Henri Nouwen. He says, a real friend isn't someone who can solve all your problems or who has an answer to every question. A real friend is someone who doesn't walk off when there are no solutions or answers, but sticks by you and remains faithful to you. It often turns out that the one who gives us the most comfort is not the person who says, hey, you should do this or say that or go there, but the one who, even if there is no good advice to give, says, whatever happens, I'm your friend. You can count on me. And the older you become, the more you discover that your joy and happiness depends on such friendships. The great secret of life is that suffering, which often seems so unbearable, can become, through compassion, a source of new life and new hope. It's so interesting. I had a list the last time I did this of the names that were my safe places, and some of my safe places have changed over the years for a lot of reasons. It's been hard for me to face that. I want to tell you guys, it's been so hard for me to face that. It's harder still to allow new voices in. But I got to say that these days God is developing for this old guy a pretty beautiful balance of historic voices and newer voices that I'm allowing to protect me. Can I just tell you what's so true about me? I don't want to be needy. I don't want to be vulnerable. I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to be the guy who's talked about. I don't want to be the guy who has that stuff. I don't want to be needful of you. But if I don't, I won't get loved. And I won't get protected. And I won't get my wrong conclusions challenged. And I won't get brought home. So I need you. I desperately need you. We desperately need each other. It's why we have to figure out to make small groups work and to make small environments. We have to not just show up on Sunday or it won't work, this place. We have to be able to do that. It's a place so safe where the worst of me can be known. Because this isn't static and it's not a game. So, some of us have, right in this room, and we can't even see it, because I had done it and you didn't see it. Some of us have already packed our bags. Some of us just can't remember why we stay. Some of us have come back from Solomon's journey, but we're really jaded and cynical. Some of us have come back and we're trusting again. And some of us, oh, you guys, we have learned to trust and enjoy Jesus in a way that allows us to never have to leave. Would you consider this for me? What if we did something in this series? What if we kept a journal? What if we actually got a journal? You got one, you went to some conference, some health conference, and they give you a really nice leather, but it's got their name written across and you never used it, and it's just sat there. Go find that. Or go to a thrift store. Find a cool-looking journal that feels real comfortable to you. And would you go through this series and just write down the things that you might never say? God, I'm feeling this right now. I'm going through this. And just as we're going through, just as you're reading through, keep reading through Ecclesiastes. Now with that template, give me that new template again. And at the top of your journal, find somewhere, get this slide when it's put up later in the week, and use this template. Am I right now looking at life just under the sun? God, stay over there. No. And I'm just seeing, what can I do that can pay off for John? And so that's a great template to be able to ask yourself. Or am I doing that again as I did in that 3-year period of time? I was saying to myself, I was a self-referencing system. I was self-protective. Still can be. Am I doing that again? Am I saying just to myself, am I not letting anyone in? Is this all just John talking to John? And then that third one, am I doing that again? Have I tested all this with wisdom? I know better than everybody else. My wisdom has to reign supreme. So ask yourself all the time, give yourself permission as you're reading through this, writing in a journal those honest thoughts. Yeah, I'm there again. I'm in those threads again, underneath. I'm underneath the tapestry, and I can't see clearly, and I'm blaming God for not doing it right, and everything doesn't make order. There's no sense. There's no rhyme to it. It's all ridiculous feeling. Oh, God, could I call out, God, let me see from on top of the tapestry. God, you are so good. You make no mistakes. You're not playing me. You have a beautiful purpose for my life. You have wonderful order that you're bringing to this thing that can feel like chaos. Oh, God, I see it today. That template, you guys, would be a beautiful way to walk through this series. Here's what I have. Some of you don't. Some of you just walked in this room and it's brand new to you, and it's okay. Just keep coming. I love that we're going through Ecclesiastes. For someone who is just starting their faith journey, Ecclesiastes is so honest. I love that we're in it. But while Stu teaches, when Caleb teaches, when Clint teaches, you know what's true about us that's different than Solomon? The day of Pentecost. We have the indwelling Jesus Christ, who all the time says, I love you. I know who you are, and there's no condemnation. And you don't have to run. You are so precious to me. There's no ever time when you don't have everything of me. I've got you. I'm not up here and you're down here. We're fused together. Oh, kid. You don't have to run. I have this life of us together that is all you've ever wanted. It's all you've been looking for. And I can give meaning to everything, to your children, to everything you taste and touch and all the things that you work at and give your life to. I can bring, as a gift, I can bring joy to you. We have that Solomon didn't have. Guys, this is going to be a incredibly beautiful, reconfirming, and sometimes reevaluating journey. I'm so proud to be on it with you.